The traffic, I am happy to report, has cleared up in Los Angeles, and Dustin Hoffman has arrived at the studios of NPR West in Culver City. Dustin Hoffman is a movie star who often says he's really a character actor, a two-time Oscar winner, and recipient of a Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Film Institute, who's also made pictures he describes as doo-doo. He's co-starred with his old friend Gene Hackman in his most recent picture, Runaway Jury. Several more films are in the works. He's also involved in a project with author Joe Garner called Now Showing, Unforgettable Moments from the Movies. He hosts the accompanying DVD, and he joins us from NPR West. Dustin Hoffman, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, how do you do, Anil?
Very well, thank you. You made it through traffic.
Well, here's a question. Is it the same no matter where you live in any city, or is it a metaphor for Hollywood? In other words, you're stacked up on the freeway. Out of nowhere, you suddenly get stacked up, and then you wonder what's happened. You think a terrible accident or whatever, and then suddenly, 2 miles down the road, you discover the reason for it, and the traffic is cleared completely, and it's simply some guy getting a ticket from a cop. But both cars, the cop's cars and the guy who's getting the ticket, are on the shoulder, so they never have been interrupting the traffic. Does that mean that I'm in the right business? Meaning everybody likes to slow down to see theater?
I think they like to slow down to see potential disasters.
I see. And also to just kind of, it's just that feeling of, you know, that good hit of not being the one that got the ticket, maybe.
And given what we've been seeing on the news lately, they probably all have video cameras and hoping to make a fortune from the ensuing events. If any of you have a question for Dustin Hoffman about his films or his career in acting, give us a phone call. Our number here is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And how did you get involved in this project with Joe Garner?
Well, I didn't know him before he called, and it was one of the, you know, we get, as you say, movie star character slash hyphenate character actors get requests, and this was one that popped out because it promised to allow the viewer of the DVD while they're reading the book to mm-hmm. not only see scenes from films, really classic films, but to get information on the intricate, you know, things that happened during those signature scenes. And as Joe told me, most of them were accidents, and I'm aware of signature scenes in films that I've done that were accidents. And
give me a for instance.
Midnight Cowboy, I guess, when I say I'm walking here, that was a real cab that almost hit us, and that came out of fear, and we had done the take about, the scene about 10 times. It was a hidden camera across the street. Those were not extras. Those were real people walking in New York City, real traffic. And we were supposed to cross the street at a certain point. And we kept doing the take over and over again because every time we'd get to the corner, we couldn't time it, the dialogue with the red light, green light, because it was real lights. They weren't fixed. We finally make it, and the dialogue is perfect at the point that the signal turns green, and we start to cross, and that cab almost hit us, and that becomes, you know, one of the signature moments of the movie.
I was even wondering in your drive over to the studios if you didn't have a problem getting out of the car and yelling, "Hey, I'm driving here."
My imagination immediately goes, the driver yells back, "Hey, I'm getting a ticket."
Now, it happens that one of your pictures is number 6 in this list of Joe Garner's great moments in movie history. Let's listen to a clip from this memorable scene from The Graduate, you and Anne Bancroft.
For God's sake, Mrs. Robinson, here we are. You got me into your house. You give me a drink. You put on music. Now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
I still laugh every time I hear that pause.
That's Nichols. That's pure Mike Nichols. That's the brilliance, one of the brilliant aspects of Mike.
When we come back after a short break, we're going to continue talking with Dustin Hoffman about his career in movies and begin taking your calls. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest is two-time Academy Award winner Dustin Hoffman. If you have questions about his career, his many roles, or his craft, give us a call, 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. And Dustin Hoffman, just before the break, we were playing a clip from the movie The Graduate, number 6 in that greatest movie moments of all time. But that was a part that I think you were told when you were up for that part, you didn't look the role.
Well, exactly. I mean, that was from a book by Charles Webb, a wonderful novel called The Graduate. And that guy was white Anglo-Saxon Protestant from New England area. He had been in the book, you know, star of his debating team and the track star. And, you know, if you were reading the book at the time, you would picture Robert Redford. And I think that there's no other director I know of at that time or even today that made that kind of miscalculation in casting, which turned out to be fortuitous.
It's interesting. 2 years after The Graduate in 1969, you got the role of Ratso Rizzo in Midnight Cowboy. You talked a little bit about that movie earlier. But in an interview in NPR in 1994, the director, John Schlesinger, recalled that based on what he knew of you as an actor, he thought you were a little too Joe College to play the part. We're going to listen to an excerpt of what he said in the interview.
I can't judge him from just seeing The Graduate. He's certainly not Ratso Rizzo looking at that movie. So I went to New York and met him, and he had the great presence of mind to dress as he envisaged Ratso in a dirty old raincoat. And we wandered along 42nd Street and went to an Italian restaurant somewhere nearby where he said, I'm taking you to this restaurant because if Ratso Rizzo had been a success, I think he would have ended up as head waiter. And there was this extraordinary character of the head waiter who existed, and I could see exactly what Dustin meant. And then we spent a lot of time in pool halls and all-night cafes and so forth. And by the end of the evening, it was quite clear to me that he blended into the scene perfectly, and there was no point in looking any further, and that's how he got the part.
Dustin Hoffman, is that the way you remember it?
Yeah, it is, and hearing John's voice is it makes me miss him even more. He died recently. You know, it was a tribute to Nichols to cast me because he's hearing an inner voice rather than just you know, product, which is very much what is happening in films today. And I think the same is true of Schlesinger because I had become an instant star off The Graduate, and the idea today would be grab him. It doesn't matter whether he's right or wrong for Ratso Rizzo, but he also was an artist, and he wanted to make sure that casting, you know, was the vision that he had. But the way he recollects it is the way I recollect it.
I've always been curious after hearing that clip of tape. Was the Italian restaurant Toffanetti's?
It was Giordano's.
Giordano's. Giordano's. Yeah.
And before that, we were in an automat. I don't think it's there anymore on 42nd Street.
No, I think it's gone.
It became Disneyland something.
42nd Street has changed.
Yes, God knows. And his actual sentence, I remember, which he didn't say in the interview portion I heard just now. He said, oh, well, you'll he just looked at me, and he looked around at everyone else and couldn't see a difference. And he says, oh, you'll do quite well. And the one inaccuracy he has in the interview, as I recall it, is he said I had gotten dressed myself and went out and got clothing, dirty old raincoat. Those were my clothes. Those were the clothes of an unemployed actor for 12 years preceding The Graduate, and I didn't have any more money after The Graduate than before. I just used the ones that I put in the laundry, took it out before they were done.
We're speaking with actor Dustin Hoffman. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 800-989-8255. Let's begin with John, who's on the phone with us from Portland, Oregon.
Yes, sir. Mr. Hoffman, I would like to ask you about your role as Lenny Bruce in Lenny.
Sure.
At the opening, you said that your roles have changed your life. And I was wondering how that particular role changed your life, if it did at all.
I'm sorry, what did you mean by the opening?
There was an opening clip.
There was a clip at the beginning of the program. You were still in the car, I think, at that point.
Right. What was the clip?
You talked about how some of the big roles that you had played had allowed you to broaden yourself and expand your personality.
You know, I don't know expand my personality. I mean, every role that I've done, I guess, it affects you. I mean, if you're a journalist, every story you've done, and I guess in life, almost many people that one meets alters you. In this particular case, I did about 3 months research on Lenny Bruce. I met his mother. Because I was told, if you want to know about Lenny Bruce, meet his mother, because that's who Lenny was really doing. And she had been a former stripper, dancer, showgirl, and Lenny grew up in that circumstance. Anyways, I met his mother, and she promptly took me to Las Vegas for a couple of weeks, because there were so many comedians there that knew Lenny intimately. And I think the thing about Lenny that struck me the most was that he was not a comedian in the conventional sense, according to the people that knew him. He didn't sit around in the cafes with other comedians and try to top, you know, the way they top each other with jokes. He would be quiet. He would be focused on people, not unlike an actor would or a writer. And they'd suddenly turn around and he was no longer at the table, and they'd go looking for him, and he was in the kitchen, literally just talking to the help in the kitchen. He was a very interesting person, and I think what I walked away with most was the extraordinary, which I think the film, Bob Fosse's film, captures, is the naivete that he really felt that he was going to be protected under the Constitution, of free speech, and that what he was doing was not obscene, and it wasn't. It was not, in other words, if the definition is to, you know, to arouse, sexually arouse, that's not what he was about. And he did open the door for he tilted the axis of American comedy. It was Richard Pryor that came after that, and subsequent people, George Carlin, Chris Rock, you know, everyone.
Thanks for the call, John.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you. Thanks for liking Bob's film.
I was wondering, you're talking about those other comics as if you're very familiar with their work. Do you watch them? Do you study them at all?
Still?
Yeah.
That's an interesting question for me, because I think that comics are the deepest of that. It is maybe one of the deepest art forms that exists. I mean, it's, I think, as deep as music, in the sense that, you know, they say music is the first art form we respond to as a human being. You know, we even hear it when we're still in utero and after we're born. I mean, there is this, we start bouncing with it. It hits a part of the brain, I think, that is still unexplainable. But I think comedy is equal to that, in the sense that it gets short shrift in our culture. It hits very deep, because it's not just a laugh that's coming out of this. It's a shock of deep recognition when it's really a good joke. And it's the joke is an ironic word for it. I think of movies as jokes. I think a movie is one big joke and a bunch of little jokes connected. The joke meaning you're setting the audience up and then you're hitting them. And a good joke, like a good movie, it comes from because you didn't see it coming. That's what makes you really laugh. You can't stop it. Hmm. You're hit in a way that you didn't think you were going to be hit, or at the moment you thought you were going to be hit.
What was the first movie that hit you that way?
Oh, Bambi. It was a cartoon. I think it's the first movie I ever saw. And later, after I grew up, someone mentioned it to me about all the things that were supposed to be for children, and even today are supposed to be for children. Some of them are so violent. Those animals running out of the jungle, some of them being burnt to death, and then someone turned me toward Pinocchio and his legs being burnt because he slept by the fireplace. And if you're a parent, you know, you start to read this stuff to your kids, and you haven't pre-read it nor read it in a long time, and suddenly we get to that point and you just turn the pages and jump or make up stuff, because that Bambi was, you know, it destroyed me.
Clearly you've recovered.
Yes. Well, you know, I feel maybe it's set me up as having such a great love for animals.
Here's an email question we have from Brian Hill in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Please ask Mr. Hoffman about his experience acting opposite Laurence Olivier in one of my favorite movies, The Marathon Man. Was Olivier as impressive off-screen as he was on?
When I knew him, he was more impressive, because the people that knew him knew how many illnesses he was fighting. Only one of them being cancer. People that knew him well said the number of terrible maladies he had would have killed someone years before. He said he only agreed to do that film because he knew he was dying and he wanted to leave money to his children. He was an extraordinarily brave, courageous man, and this was a guy who held three Shakespearean leading parts in his head at once, as they used to do in those days, and play them in repertory, and with great discipline and great stamina and energy. And here he was now, unable to almost be able to remember three lines in a row because of the pain and the medication. And yet he never complained. He was stalwart and a lovely, lovely man, a rare man. He said something to me, if I'm not going on too long, at dinner. We went to dinner after the movie was over, and his wife, Joan Plowright, was there, and I think he had at least one kid that came in that was going to UCLA. And we were sitting around eating, and I admitted to him that I'd never seen him on stage because, I was an unemployed actor in America, and he did most of his stuff in London. And I said, God, you got to go back on stage, man. You got to, come on. Lee J. Cobb is in London, and he's doing King Lear, and I hear he's sitting in a chair doing it. So, even if you have to sit in a chair... he says, no. He called me dear boy. He said, no, dear boy, I haven't got it anymore. And I said, it? What's it? And he came right nose to nose with me. And he said, what's it? Look at me, 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 look at me. And that just chilled me. And nothing is defined why we do what we do more accurately or simply than that.
I have to ask you, and this, as far as I know, I've read this line that he's attributed to in the taping of the process of filming that movie. You were said to have stayed awake for 2 days to be right for that part in the movie when you were supposed to have been awake for 2 days, the exhaustion. And he is supposed to have said, why doesn't the dear boy just act?
Well, it's become, it's God knows, more than slightly distorted. I told that story to Time magazine, and then they reinterpreted it because it made a better story. I was in New York shooting. My marriage, first marriage, was falling apart. It was a good excuse to party. And, the reason to stay up 2 days wasn't just because the character stayed up 2 days. It was because, I was partying. It was Studio 54, and I rationalized it by saying, so that was, I think, the deeper reason. When I got to Los Angeles and we continued filming, and I was laughing, talking to I call him Lordage, talking to Lordage about this, we both laughed. And he says, why don't you try acting? But there was irony there, which I said in the Time interview, which unfortunately was left out. And Joan Plowright agreed with me later when she said to me, Larry, of all people, she said, didn't just act. He was always looking for new, absolutely extraordinary ways and things to do a part in a way that no one had done it before, that went beyond acting. For instance, she said in the last scene, or one of the last scenes of Hamlet, where, Hamlet starts murdering everybody, she said, Larry did it, jumped from 30 feet up. On a scaffolding of the set, and if he didn't land right on this actor's shoulders, they both would have broken their neck. And he was, he did it. And I always felt that there was, according to the version that Time did, there would have been another Olivier standing there saying to Sir Lawrence, why don't you just try acting? So that's the spirit in which he said it. I think the story, in a sense, does a disservice to him, because he was adventurous. Acting didn't have boundaries to him.
We're speaking with Dustin Hoffman. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's take another phone call. This is Kent, who's with us from Nashville, Tennessee.
Hi, it's really an honor to speak with you both. I do have a question, but first I want to say that, Mr. Hoffman, you said at the beginning that the roles you played had had changed your life, and I want you to know that I think that the depth of your performances has certainly widened the spectrum of my life, and I think a lot of other people. I want to thank you for it. My question is, one of my favorite roles that you've done is a film that I thought was overlooked badly at the time by the Academy, and sometimes overlooked still, was Papillon. I thought that both you and Steve McQueen were spectacular in that movie, and that those roles were overlooked. I'd just like to hear your thoughts about that role.
You know, it's interesting. That was during the Vietnam War, and that was at a time where there was a real public backlash to anything on screen that had any kind of violent implications. I mean, in today's world, it would be practically, you know, PG, or, you know, for all kids. I mean, because we've deteriorated so much in that aspect. But there was a guillotine scene in that movie. You know, a man was beheaded. It was somewhat graphic, and I think that scene alone really turned critics against it. So it was really reviewed mercilessly, in a sense. That was directed by Franklin Schaffner, and I really think he did a wonderful job directing it. I think it's one of I agree with you, sir, that I think it's one of McQueen's best performances. It was a long shoot. It was the only shoot I've ever been on where the film was stopped a few weeks into shooting because they ran out of money, and because it was such an expensive movie. And Jamaica's where we shot it. The Jamaican government impounded the equipment that was there until the producer was literally running around Europe trying to you know, get more money. And then we went back to shooting the film. Written by Charrier, there was a lot of controversy about him. Had he really escaped from Devil's Island? And I did. You know, I like research because I just enjoy it. And I had gone to the New York Public Library, and I had taken a few books out on Devil's Island, and one of them was called, I think somewhat respected book at the time, early 1900s, was called Dry Guillotine. I remember it. And there were passages in Dry Guillotine that were literally almost word for word the same passages in the novel. So, you know, you can take from that what you will. But McQueen was a very interesting man. He had spent a lot of time as a youth in he brought something to the character that was extra, I think, in that which you may have picked up. He had spent a lot of time in youth authority, in prison, as a kid, as a teenager. There was a convict aspect to Steve that he brought to that part.
Kent, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
Today on Talk of the Nation, our guest is two-time Academy Award winner Dustin Hoffman. If you have a question about his career, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Many people will remember Dustin Hoffman for his role as actor Michael Dorsey, a.k.a. Dorothy Michaels, a.k.a. Tootsie. Here's a scene from that movie where Sidney Pollack, playing his agent, explains to Michael why he's unhirable in New York.
I can't even send you up for a commercial. You played a tomato for 30 seconds. They went a half a day over schedule because you wouldn't sit down.
Yes, it wasn't logical.
You were a tomato! A tomato doesn't have logic! A tomato can't move!
That's what I said. So if he can't move, how's he going to sit down, George? I was a stand-up tomato, a juicy, sexy beefsteak tomato. Nobody does vegetables like me. I did an evening of vegetables off Broadway. I did the best tomato, the best cucumber. I did an endive salad that knocked the critics on their ass.
Dustin Hoffman, a lot of people said that role was a big stretch for you. I don't know why. You were playing an unemployed actor.
Yes, that there was a satire involved. That movie was started by myself from an idea that my friend Murray Siskel, one of the co-writers, my longtime dear friend Murray Siskel, had. And that was, first of all, many of us have thought, you know, well, what is it like to be the opposite sex, you know, as a man? You know, what would it feel like to be a woman? And if you're a woman, what would it feel like to be a man? But Murray came up with something I'd never heard before, which is, how would I be different, essentially? How would my essence, my persona be different if I had been born a woman? And the first thing that came to my mind, it was just a discussion we had over a few drinks, I think at my father-in-law's 50th birthday. And my first question was, well, how good-looking would I be? Because I felt that what had formed me in my youth was my unattractiveness, or certainly my feeling of unattractiveness. And once we carried that thought through, I realized that I would not have approached this Dorothy Michaels at a party because she wouldn't have fulfilled the external requirements that I was raised to believe counted. And that was a deep thread that ran through that movie of how many interesting women that I had left out of my life. The other aspect of it was, it's in the scene that you just played.
Mm-hmm.
Every actor that ever existed, certainly during that time, was such a rich period. We came from such a rich period. The teachers were giants, icons. I don't think they've been replaced. Sandy Meisner, Stella Adler, Bobby Lewis, Lee Strasberg. I mean, these were the teachers that we young actors studied with. And it was going to Temple to learn our craft. And it was year after year after year after year, because an actor doesn't get work for a while. 10% work. Not necessarily the best ones either.
Mm.
And then you try to get a job, and you get a job, let's say, and the director's saying, move left, move right, and you say, but that's not organic. My character wouldn't, and you're fired immediately. And the particular scene that you played, that is a tribute to Zero Mostel. I improvised that scene with one of the writers, Larry Gelbart, and we taped it, because Zero Mostel, when he was blacklisted, you know, he had to resort to doing these off Broadway shows, and he played a mixed salad, and he was brilliant.
if listeners have not seen Zero Mostel and the original producers, or he's also in The List. Didn't Woody Allen make that film with him?
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yes. It's a terrific role. Here's an email question we have. This is from Pia Newman in Philadelphia. Not a question, she writes, but a comment. When I first saw Rain Man, I found it a very good and interesting film and didn't give it any more thought than that. Now I have a 12-year-old son with autism and can appreciate what an incredibly accurate and sensitive portrayal of high-functioning autism Mr. Hoffman achieved. I've even had the eerie experience of seeing my son say something or make a gesture for the first time, which I'd previously seen in the movie, but he hadn't. A lot of research involved in that part?
Well, about 3 years. A lot of times research that I've done has taken the time because it took that long to get the script right, or it took that long to get a studio to say yes. In this case, Tom Cruise, for a period there, you know, he and I had bonded in terms of this film. We had done research together, and then he went off to make a film. And part of the reason why we didn't go sooner was he was shooting this other film, and that allowed me to do more research. The best part of the entire research was meeting Temple Grandin, who wrote a book called The Autobiography of an Autistic Person. And the other one was meeting Oliver Sacks, the tremendous psychiatrist, who wrote Awakenings and The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. And the things that they told me were really, I think, the backbone of what I was trying to accomplish.
Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Shane. And Shane joins us from Rockville, Maryland. Hello, Shane. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi. Just wanted to say hi. Having a nostalgic moment, Dusty. It's Shane Bergner, Lloyd Bergner's daughter, calling.
Oh, my gosh. Well, should we interject real quickly? I almost died from a terrible burn accident I had in New York as a struggling actor, and I was hospitalized, and her father saved my life. He later showed me the card. I was listed as terminal.
You
give my love to Dr. Bergner, to Lloyd.
Wow. Best to you, and I have now 5 children of my own, and we are raising another generation of fans, you should know.
Oh, so nice to talk to you. How is your dad?
He's wonderful, thank God. He's terrific.
Is he still practicing surgery?
Yes, he is.
Oh, well, perhaps we'll get a chance to visit, not on the NPR audience's time.
Well, Shane, when did you get a chance to meet, when did you first meet Dustin Hoffman?
My parents knew him, I think, probably years back, and I remember my 7th birthday party, him coming to the Rye Recreation Center, and The Graduate was a popular movie. That was in 1970. The Graduate had been a major smash hit, and I guess word traveled quickly, and it was a public place where we held my birthday party, and we had a clown and the whole routine, And they ended up having to whisk him away and hide him because every teenager within a 20-mile radius had heard and converged on my 7th birthday party. So I remember vivid events like that. I remember weekends. And I remember Marathon Man being shot near my home when I was, I guess, 12. I still have the mailgram that Dusty sent me when I was having my bat mitzvah.
Yeah. And 2 years earlier, you probably could have booked him as the clown.
Well, probably. Very, he was always the most fun to play with.
I did that job. been there. Very good.
Shane, go ahead, I'm sorry.
The one that was tougher than a clown was a fire-breathing dragon, in which I had a dragon suit on, and the fire smoke was really talcum powder, and I had to push a squeeze thing that was hidden in the costume with my wrist, and every time I did, the talcum went down my throat, and I almost went to the hospital from talcum poisoning. Better a clown.
Better a clown. That was Donald O'Connor's line, be a clown.
Right? Yes.
Shane, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye, Shane.
Let's go to, tell our listeners that you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News, and our guest is Dustin Hoffman. And now let's go to Lori, and Lori's with us from Westlake, Ohio.
Hi there.
Hi.
I, like a lot of people, didn't see Ishtar because of the critics. And my friend Ro Moser was bugging me. They bought it. She said, you have to see it. So finally I went over. It was probably 11 o'clock at night and saw the movie. And I was quietly weeping, laughing. I was laughing so much. I hadn't laughed like that since reading Catch-22. It had that kind of effect. And I wanted to thank you for that movie and ask you if you guys had as much fun, you and the camel, of course, you and Warren Beatty and the camel had as much fun as it seemed like watching that movie. It seemed like you had a blast.
I think everyone in their lifetime has something they haven't quite figured out. I like that film as much as you do. Just about everyone I've ever met that makes a face when the name is brought up has not seen it. That's right. And, you know, I've bumped into people like certainly Simon and Garfunkel and Sting and Bruce Springsteen. And people in the music business have a fondness for that film because they know middle-aged guys who have been struggling to become one of them since they were 18, 19 years old, still struggling, still at it.
Yeah.
You know, second-rate talent. There's an underlying message to that movie, you know, that I think made it worth doing, and I would do it again in a second, that Elaine May had. And that, because if you remember the beginning of the movie, they're singing That's Amore, and at the end of the movie, they're singing it again in Morocco, like in a Holiday Inn.
Uh-huh.
And I think what she was talking about in that film is that isn't it better to be second rate and love what you're doing?
Yeah.
Then be first rate and have no passion for it, and as we were talking about before, so comedy's a serious business, and that was underneath the comedy, I think.
Well, it was just mentioned on the Tavis Smiley show, and every time I hear anybody refer to it, I think, did you even see it? I didn't give an opinion about it, but I'd say, well, I heard how it was, but then I saw it and I knew how great it was, and there's even on a local Cleveland NPR show, they have film critics every once in a while, and one of them, I can't remember the guy's name, had the courage to come out on the radio and say, I really loved Ishtar.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it cost too much money. It was $40 million, I think, which was today, God knows what it would be.
Uh-huh.
And that was the first time, I think, the cost of a film ever got to the public. It was around the time that the public suddenly was aware of how much films cost, how much they made on a weekend. And it's a comedy. And I remember at the time thinking, I wouldn't want to be a comedian trying to get a laugh from an audience that had paid, let's say, $5,000 a ticket at a benefit. You know, they would turn to each other and say, that's not a $5,000 joke. You know, and I think the audiences that did see it, or certainly the critics, went to that movie, you know, with an agenda before they even saw it.
Exactly.
Lori, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
appreciate it. And we just have a couple of minutes left, but sure. I have to ask you, you are of an age where, as as a younger person, you had to have heard the records that were done by Mike Nichols and Elaine May. I mean, they had a stand-up routine. It was on a lot of records and around at the time, and these were some of the funniest things that were ever put on records. And you had to have listened to those as when you were younger, didn't you?
Yes. I mean, my first response to what you're saying is to the audience, run, don't walk, because you can get them on CD. Get those routines of Mike Nichols and Elaine May. They were brilliant.
And you ended up being directed by both of them.
That's, oh my gosh, I never thought of that. Wow. Yes. And by the way, when I was doing Lenny, Mike Nichols told me that they were performing in the same nightclub that just above them in a place called the Duplex on Sunset Boulevard. And when Nichols and May would finish their act, they would run downstairs to catch this new comic, Lenny Bruce, they said, because he was the first comedian to just do an entire act without preparation, not even knowing what he was going to say. And he carried it off. But you're right, Nichols and May, they're brilliant people. She's an uncredited writer and a major writer in Tootsie. She did not want credit for it because she didn't initiate the idea. But that movie would not have happened without Elaine.
What did she write?
She wrote a great deal. There was when she came on that film, she was the next to the last writer. Siskel was the first and the last, but there was no roommate. There was no Bill Murray part. There was no Jessica Lange father. There was no Jessica Lange boyfriend with Dabney Coleman. I mean, she created characters that formed that film. She gave it not only character, she gave it structure, and she gave it some of the best laughs that we have in that film. She did, percentage-wise, she did 50% of that movie easily.
Dustin Hoffman, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate fighting the traffic.
I thank you and I apologize for being late. And I agree with one of your listeners. It's an honor to meet you. I enjoyed you for years.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We're going to end now with a song from Rain Man, the film that won Dustin Hoffman his second Academy Award. This is Iko Iko, performed by the Bell Stars. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.